Welcome to the first ever Music Business Worldwide podcast with me, Tim Ingham. Every month we'll be having a special guest joining us. They will be some of the smartest, the most influential figures from across the global music industry. Before we begin, I'd like to say thank you to our supporter, CI, who offer digital music delivery expertise, working with some of the biggest independent labels, distributors, aggregators in the world. I'd also like to offer my thanks to Tune Tribe Entertainment Group, who make this podcast possible. The gentleman joining us today has worked at the top of the record business across various highly influential companies, including Island Records, EMI, and Sony Music. He's worked closely with acts including Radiohead, Blur, Amy Winehouse, Deadmau5, and One Direction. He recently set up his own organisation, Twin Music Inc., to develop, manage, and help fund artists and entrepreneurs in music business at early stages. And that gentleman is Nick Catfield. Nick, welcome to the MBW podcast.
Thank you. Very happy to be your first guest.
So you left Sony last year, so you've had a bit of a gap between setting up Twin. I wanted to ask you, now you're a fully-fledged independent organisation, is there anything you miss from that major world? And also, what's most exciting you about flying solo?
It's been coming up to 18 months now since I left Sony. I could highly recommend for anybody who's spent as long as I have in the major label world, and sadly I have to admit it's approaching 30 years, a change is as good as the rest. I think everybody needs a sabbatical from, the day-to-day running of a major music company, because what you discover is you fall back in love with the process again, and you fall back in love with music and discovery. And of course, we're all music fans. Everybody in a major label is a huge music fan. But the day-to-day of running an organisation, you kind of get slightly removed for the reason why you came into it in the first place.
Sure.
So, yeah, what I miss about the major is obviously you miss the check. Yeah, no shit. And, you miss the camaraderie because, whatever organisation I've worked with, I've had the pleasure of working with some fantastic colleagues and obviously fantastic artists. But the business is fundamentally changing and evolving, and I always look at myself and go, okay, I've always had a desire for entrepreneurship, and I've invested in businesses in the past, and I thought there was an opportunity here that the business is changing. It's a watershed moment in music, and for me to do something on my own, entrepreneurial, and particularly working with early stage artists where I think there is a void in that kind of support, I thought there was a unique opportunity.
I'll ask you about Twin shortly. There's a lot of curiosity out there in the industry. Certainly it was one of my most read stories this year when I hinted what you may be up to. But before we get there, you're certainly one of, I said it before when we were outside, one of the most influential British music executives, certainly of the past 20 years. In all of that time, across all those great companies, Island, EMI, Sony, etc., what was your proudest achievement?
Well, that is a difficult question. But I mean, without sounding a little bit trite, it's working with some of the incredible artists that I've had the pleasure to work with. And clearly, you mentioned some of them, but Radiohead and seeing them in the Jericho Tavern in front of 15 people and then seeing what they become, and of course Amy Winehouse, and I just I was involved with the film, and I just went to the screening of the final movie last week, and there was a moment in that film, if I ask about one single event, it was when she won the 5 Grammys for Back to Black. And not only that was an amazing achievement for her, but there was, because she couldn't travel to America because of some of the drug issues surrounding her, we had to host an event at Riverside Studios in London and beamed it live via satellite to the Grammys. And there was something really subversive and funny and incredibly British about that. Because I remember the conversation around the Grammys going, well, of course, you can't have any alcohol on the tables, which we all went, well, fuck that. It's going to be 3 o'clock in the morning. Are you kidding? And so you've got a sort of room full of people in incredibly euphoric, slightly drunk, going, there you are in America, all sitting in a very dry auditorium. Because if anybody's been to the Grammys, it's interminable and you're not allowed to drink. So, and we just did nothing but drink. But it was just a huge party. And I think what made it so incredibly special is, and you'll see this if you see the film, which is a remarkable film, I have to say, is she was in the best form of her life. And she played songs, you know, there's extraordinary stuff that's really never been seen. You know, she was just having fun. And I think that's, I remember sitting there thinking, this is an utterly unique occasion. This will never happen again. Not the Grammy wins, but the fact that it's in this environment. So I point to that. And of course, it's very fresh in my mind because of the Amy Winehouse documentary.
And by the time this podcast is being listened to, that will hopefully be number one in the box office across the country. I mean, what's your main takeaways from the film? What's your quick capsule review, I suppose?
Again, I think Asif and James have done a remarkable job putting this together. And it's incredible forensic work because, you know, I was involved more so at the beginning of this at the end. But, you know, you think you know everything about it. But the stuff they were pulling out, which I was thinking, where on earth did you get some of this footage? Some very personal stuff, some very, you know, stuff from her early childhood. I think the most remarkable thing about it, though, is, you know, if you look at the storyline, it's quite a familiar story, actually. It could be Marilyn Monroe. It could be that, you know, you've got an incredible talent, and in Amy's case, who lives for the music and can't handle the fame and the pressures that come with it. And you see the rise and fall of it. The exceptional thing about it, and the extraordinary thing about this film, is every single episode of that is documented, is filmed. So you see every moment of that journey. And it's a terrible lesson. You know, particularly when you know, I mean, nobody's responsible and everybody's responsible.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think everybody who was involved with Amy at the time, and we all tried to do the right thing, including her father, including Ray Cosbert, you know, especially Ray, I have to say, maybe the film doesn't reflect that. And I think a lot of people in the record company were very much trying to do the right thing, but nobody knew what to do. And there was so much conflicting advice at the time from so-called experts. Oh, she needs something to look forward to, so you have to book a gig in. Oh, don't do a gig. Yeah. It was nuts. And it's a, you know, it's a cliche, but now it's a cliche that's true, is the only person that can help themselves is the person.
And well, everyone that I've spoken to about it has said people should flock to the cinema and see it. So,
Oh, it's brilliant. It really is a fantastic film. And in fact, I'd actually suggest that, you know, I had certain moments in my career where there's certain things that artists should see. That's one of those things that every aspiring artist should look at, not just because of the dangers of how you handle fame or the pressures that come with it. That's a lesson enough. But you also see moments of an artist, you go, she was without doubt the purest artist I've ever come across. It was entirely about the music. Nothing else mattered to her. And you see someone absolutely on top of their game in certain episodes of there, and you go, wow, well, that's talent.
And at Twin Music, you're going to hopefully have a number of aspiring artists, so you can give that advice too.
Wow.
I wanted to ask, well, first and foremost, what's the problem you're trying to solve?
I think it is, and again, you know, this is by no means this is sort of a jab at the majors. You know, there's a huge amount of pressure, you know, when it comes to developing new talent, and you know, I think the opportunities have never been greater for new talent, but equally well, you know, because it's almost like a tsunami of opportunity. And now, obviously, with whether it's Beats Music or Apple Music, rather, or Spotify, or the huge platforms that artists have, you know, I actually think early stage incubation and development is more critical than it's ever been. And that's something I think most of the major companies have steered away from. And I understand that entirely, and there's no criticism. When I was running Sony, or whether it was EMI, you know, investing in very early stage artists is a very high risk exercise. So I think one of the deals that I did at EMI, and you mentioned it earlier, was the Deadmau5 deal. And it was a very interesting process, and that kind of gave me an awful lot of sort of, you know, kind of steering points of where I wanted to go with Twin. So Deadmau5 was very much a arrangement in the same kind of way that you'd angel invest in a business. Mm-hmm. You know, he had a startup business, a little beyond a startup, but at that time it was still underground. He required investment and some expertise to be able to broaden the business, grow his live show, and have an international structure behind him where, you know, he could start really developing his business. And so what we did was we created a JV with him, effectively Deadmau5 Inc., where, you know, EMI at that time, you know, we invested and we put expertise and our international structure around him. And he put all his brilliance and his intellectual property in that. And we sat and met as a company. And we had strategic decisions in the company. And one of the things which is interesting with that, we strategically decided not to commercially exploit his music, i.e. he had so many offers at that time for tracks and someone to do a top line here and the idea that you'd ram a hit home. And actually, when you looked at the overall business, you go, well, actually, it's growing brilliantly through the underground. Mm-hmm. So we're just going to keep music out there, you know, keep it underground, keep it a little bit left of center, make it widely available and watch this live music grow. And the rest of the business will come up around it. And that's exactly what happened.
So it wasn't a sort of records first strategy?
Well, no. And I think, you know, and it's a very simple reason, you know, if you just have recorded music rights, or if that is by far the majority of your income, you're going to be pushing to exploit that beyond anything else. It's just a natural, you know, it's the way things are. And my thing, if you look at the overall business and say, okay, what is in the best interest of the business, which we're shareholders in, you take a very different approach. Now, of course, you know, that's not rocket science. We all figured out that, oh, yeah, it's 360-degree deals. But unfortunately, I think where majors are right now, you forfeit the right to have that relationship with an artist because you don't invest early enough. Mm-hmm. And what I'm trying to do with Twin is I'm investing very early. So, yes, there's risk on my part, but it's a reasonably low risk, and I hope it's an educated risk. And what I do with an artist is we say, right, you know, we're going to build a business platform with you, around you, with all the revenue streams that are available to you. And we're going to build an incubation strategy. So we're going to take you from point A, where you are now, to point B, where we believe you will have choices. And like a startup business, that choice may be there are third-party money coming in. That could be a major. That could be an amazing brand opportunities. It's just a platform allowing them to breathe and pursue their creativity without the, you know, that constant, I'm just going to roll over and try to license my rights to a publisher or to a major music company. And what we do, as I said, so you know, we sit with the artists, we work on a strategy together, we set KPIs, you know, key performance indicators together, saying, right, this is where we're trying to get to. We both sign off on that strategy, as you would a company. And at that point, once we both sign off on the plan, then that's the beginning of the deal. And it's a fixed term. So we're in business together for 3 years, sometimes five, depending on the nature of the artist. But at the end of that term, it's, you know, we walk away or we don't, or we stay together because the relationship's great and on we go.
You mentioned that majors may come in and invest, or yep, other parties might come in and invest. That's an exciting possibility. Where do you see the future going for the major record companies? Will they always be around? And I'm talking specifically not about the catalogues, which obviously they're sure, huge monoliths.
The catalogues will always be around. Well, to a degree.
But when it comes to those frontline artists, do you envisage that the majors will always be around to invest in that area?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question, because I think the reality is, and I think this is particularly, well, maybe it is controversial, I'll be incredibly surprised if any superstar artist renews their deal with a major on a traditional rights basis. Because why would they? And I think the reason why they wouldn't is because from an economic point of view, the days are over where Warner, Sony or Universal will overinvest for a feather in the cap of market share. It's meaningless anymore. And frankly, your shareholders won't allow it. The deal has to make economic sense. And quite hard, it's very difficult to compete with the likes of, you know, I'm Jay-Z, I can do a deal with Samsung, I can, you know, I've got Tidal clearly, but, you know, I could be with any distribution platform I want. I don't require your funding to make recorded music or necessarily make videos. Mm-hmm. There's a number of parties I can bring to it. I can control my rights, I can control my release strategy, and my margins are better. I'm not quite sure how you ever compete with that. What majors will have to do is, the good news is, there'll be money coming to the majors, because I think, you know, the growth of streaming will, the money will start flowing back into the rights holders. How they invest that money, I think, is going to be critical. And from my point of view, it absolutely has to be, funny enough, it's A&R. It's about, you know, bringing in early stage talent, really adding value through development and building different business relationships with that talent. And I also think, you know, which is a kind of maybe a strange thing to say, because, you know, I'm still consider myself an A&R guy, is, you know, A&R actually, I think, is a service which doesn't necessarily sit inside a major label anymore. I think actually A&R is a function of companies surrounding all the capability that a major can have. And what the major's capability is obviously, you know, sales and marketing, but it's consumer insight, increasingly important. They understand music consumers globally. They need to use that in the service of developing talent on a global level. You know, the relationship with brands and just the leverage they have there. it's not necessarily the handful of what I call A&R repeaters, which they are a handful in any market, who are sort of necessarily going to control the purse strings anymore, unless you're going to control the flow of talent. So I think that's going to change.
You mentioned that you still consider yourself an A&R. I mean, you're only as good as your ears now, literally, in what you back.
Yes.
That intuition also goes for the young, I would assume, young business executives that you're also backing. It's not just musical talent. What characteristics are you looking for, both in the musical talent that you get involved in, but also the executive talent?
You know, essentially, it's actually the same thing in a funny kind of way. You know, I'm not looking for somebody with a fully formed business. I don't expect to find someone with a fully formed business, nor do I expect to find an artist, which is, you know, the complete package. But what I do look for is, certainly in an executive talent, is, you know, a spark of creativity, real drive, has something unique to offer, or feels like, you know, there is a void that they can fill. And someone who I believe would benefit from, you know, mentoring, and certainly a level of support that my organisation can give them. You know, we have a number of investments rolling at the moment. One we've actually just closed, actually, which is, I'm not sure if I want to name names right now, but the names will be very forthcoming very, very soon. But it's a promotion business, which is morphing into a management business. It's very a offline, online model. And the reason why I want to make the investment is I really like the people involved in the company, and I think they're smart and they're driven, and, you know, they come with a background, ex-Radio 1 being part of it, and they look at the business in an entirely different way that people have been through my kind of career trajectory have been, and I think that's refreshing. Same kind of thing with artists as well. You know, I think on the artist side, clearly, I'm looking for somebody who is, I use the description as, you know, an artist that's been done the round of all the labels, and they've all gone, great, you know, not ready for us yet. Well, I'm ready. That's the difference. But artists also want to challenge things and do something slightly differently, and not necessarily waiting for the deal. They want to, you know, they want to get on and build a career for themselves. And, you know, a couple of deals we have closed at the moment. So we just closed the deal with an artist called Ali X, who I've been following for about a year.
Yeah, I remember.
And interestingly, I've signed to Universal in Canada. She's Canadian, so gets all the benefit of the funding out of the Canadian government. But she's fiercely independent in terms of wanting to pursue a very distinct release strategy. She's very polarizing, which is what I like. You know, you'll either hate it or love it, which is, you know, always the worst thing you can say about an act. You go, yeah, it's okay. Yeah. Just know it's doomed to failure.
There's a lot of those around.
There's loads of them around. And she's, you know, she's fiercely intelligent, and I like that. And, you know, we may kind of disappear down a blind alley, or we may change the way the model works, but she wants to go for the ride and the challenge, so that's great. And the same, so again, we are, as I say, we've closed the promotions business. We are looking at and will likely close on a consumer insight piece and the brand piece as well. So I'm looking to build a sort of a group of, you know, owner-run businesses, small owner-run businesses around a hub of artists. So they're supporting third-party artists plus twin music artists, and really sort of create a sort of a hub for new and developing talent.
You're obviously investing your money in this. There is no salary.
Yeah, madness, isn't it?
Sorry to remind you. there are probably more sensible things that you can put your cash in.
Yeah, someone told me property is a good bet.
Nah,
I don't understand that at all.
Why music? Why are you risking it again in music?
Well, you know, probably it's the only thing I'm qualified to do, or not, as maybe depends on people's opinion. I believe in the model. I believe that actually there is a business there. I just think you have to change the relationship you have with artists and how you support artists. And I love it, is the real answer. You know, I think the opportunity now is phenomenal. And, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, I went through 6 months of the money go round raising nightmare. And, you know, it got to the point where it was quite funny, where you realise it doesn't matter what your background or your history, trying to raise money on new unproven talent outside is near on impossible. So, you know, if you go out there and say, I'm buying catalogues, they'll throw cash at you. The fact of the matter is no catalogues worth buying. You know, it's a buyer's market right now, so you overpay for it, but which is hysterical because that's the way that people believe the business works. But trying to create a plan around new and developing talent, regardless of whether you're doing it in a structure in a very different way, is very hard. And what I'm trying to do is go, look, this actually works. And it works where you're not going to lose your shirt, and it's sensible, and it provides a service, it fills a niche. And by the way, we've proven the point, so there should be opportunities, whether it's for me or third parties, to start doing a similar kind of thing and investing in talent.
I want to ask you about a few of the themes that obviously we've been writing about on Music Business Worldwide. Mm-hmm. A few other sites have covered them. One of them being Apple Music. Have you had a chance to try it out?
I have.
As a consumer, what are your first impressions?
I'd say I love it, actually. Well, you know, I have Beats Music, Beats Ray, Beats One, or whatever it's calling itself, which is great.
Yeah.
You know, I think Zane's an amazing broadcaster. The principle behind it is great. It's music that appeals to me. I mean, I have to say, from a pure user interface point of view, I'm slightly baffled with the user interface because trying to find a playlist is quite hard. But I think for the sort of version 1.0, I think it's really good, really good. The interesting thing is I was speaking to a guy yesterday who made a very interesting point, actually. He said, you know, when you're starting a global radio station, he said, it'd be nice to actually be global. This guy was French, saying, you know, apart from they throw a Stromae track, who happens to be Belgian, there is not an awful lot of global music involved in it, so which I'm sure Apple have figured out, and I'm sure it will evolve and change. But you know, it's still a very Anglo-American service. You could guess, say, well, Anglo-American repertoire dominates the world, but you know, I think the nature of where the world is now, you have to create a platform for artists wherever they come from.
Absolutely.
So that should be the next iteration.
It was interesting to see Zane Lowe play AC/DC on his first day. I'm not sure if he got away with that in his last job.
I don't think so.
This is the big, tricky question, but obviously related to Apple Music. Are you optimistic about streaming and the future of the music business? I should say the future of the record business and the music business generally.
Yes, I am optimistic about streaming. But I tell you what I'm not optimistic about is the price point. Because I think the reality is $9.99 or $14.99 family plan or whatever is just not the price point. And I think we found this in the early days of Spotify. You know, and I'm a huge Spotify fan, and you know, Spotify, if anybody listens, I still use Spotify as much as I use Apple Music. We have both. Spotify, to my mind, looked like the bargain of the century. I still consider paying £10 a month to access all the music I could ever possibly want to consume an absolute bargain. But I'm probably like anybody listening to this and yourself, who are different. You know, if I didn't have the luxury of being in the business, my consumption, I'd probably spend £500 a year on music. My consumption went from £500 to £120. So all of a sudden, the really highest consumers of music, their consumption increased, their value decreased.
Yeah.
So the reality is, streaming is ever going to really rescue the business where you can get the mass market in at a price point which makes sense. And I always said this the other day, I said, look, you know, if you were starting, if you went to Silicon Valley and go, right, we've got a brilliant business model here, so we're going to aggregate all the world's music together and we're going to create this platform and we're going to suffer some horrible losses for 3 years while we get mass adoption. But I can tell you, in 3 to 5 years' time, you've got a multi, you've got Uber, basically, of music. The problem is that won't happen. Because, and that's not because, you know, everybody's got a head in the sand in music companies. You've got a legacy business. You've got old standing contracts. You've got all those kind of things to resolve and work itself around. So it's a very long rambling answer saying, yes, streaming is clearly the way people will consume music. I have no doubt about that. There is going to be, I think, quite an ugly process while we reach that tipping point between mass adoption and price.
And the physical business isn't going anywhere either.
No.
Obviously, you talked about, you know, yourself as an aficionado, that's the word people often use. Obviously, physical, not going anywhere either?
Well, it's not, you know, it decreases, although at a slower rate than I think anybody would assume it would decrease. I think one of the figures were 43, 45, 44% of, you know, the business globally is still physical product. You can't ignore that. And there's always going to be a market there of some sort. You know, vinyl surprises us constantly that, all right, it's tiny, but, you know, there are people who buy it never to play it. You know, it's one of those kind of things. You know, I look at it is again, there is a there are a vast array of music consumers who want their music in multiple different ways. There are people who just want it streamed. There are people who care about ownership. You know, my thing again, partly with Twin, and the primary goal for us is really to make that connection with your absolute hardcore fan, because those people are with you for the journey. And, you know, there's a famous old internet, you know, whatever aphorism or whatever you call it, you know, 1,000 true fans. There's a lot of truth in that. And those people want everything. You know, they want physical, digital, lyrics, tickets, everything. And I think it's incredibly important that you have to service those people, because those are the people the most loyal and stay along the journey with you.
You must have worked with a lot of inspiring executives during your career. I wanted to know which ones, as you look back, and certainly in your new role now, really stand out as ones that you've looked up to.
Yeah, it's funny. He's a gentleman I saw the other night at the Amy premiere, who, although I didn't work with him directly, I got to know him when I was running Ireland. It was Chris Blackwell. You know, I mean, actually, it was my aspiration to be Chris Blackwell, frankly, and live his life. And I had the luxury of going to Goldeneye, and, you know, there's a guy in his 70s who lives a life that anybody would like to live, but, you know, who completely backed his instincts and his guts and changed music. No doubt about it. I think he's an incredible individual. I suppose, sort of, you know, the people that really, you know, I owe a debt of gratitude to, the guy that gave me my first job in the music business was David Muntz. I always kind of sort of tell this story as, you know, I was in the band at the time, so I was in Dexys. My girlfriend was his PA. And I moaned to him, as I did on several occasions over a beer, that, like, you know, I'm so bored within this band, I just don't want to go on the road anymore. And he said, well, you know, be an A&R guy, which I thought was the ultimate sellout. Couldn't possibly do that. But then when I left the band, in a moment of, like, I'm leaving, and then I realised I had 12 quid in my account, literally, and I needed a job, I picked up the phone, and I said, you remember that A&R thing you were talking about? He said, yes, start Monday. You know, no A&R, and sorry, no HR kind of component involved in there, and, you know, psychometric testing, just come in and start. And, you know, he took a flyer, and, you know, I always appreciate that. And I think after that, probably Rupert Perry became my boss, who took a flyer on me, making me head of A&R. I was a kid, I was 25 or something. So very grateful to those people. And I have to say, and it will sound token, but I don't mean it as a token gesture. So, you know, Lucian Grange brought me back from the US into the UK. Well, I never thought I'd come back to the UK. And actually, I think probably those 7 years at Ireland were one of, if not the most enjoyable part of working within a major environment. It's creative, and, you know, Lucian's mercurial and difficult and but inspiring. And you look what, you know, what he's managed to achieve and build within Universal, and you go, wow, that's, you know, that's impressive. And I have to also tip a nod to, you know, Doug Morris, who, you look at someone like Doug and go, how on earth can you keep doing that and still have that unique combination of real business acumen? I mean, real business acumen. The guy can sit there and go, you know, Vivo, well, let's have that. We need to monetize that. I mean, no shit. But cares more deeply about the music than pretty much anybody I've ever come across in the industry. He's more about the music than anybody. That's probably covered all my career opportunities.
You don't have to worry about that anymore.
No, I'm an entrepreneur. That's right, Tim. That's right.
Nick, thank you so much for being the special guest of the first ever Music Business Worldwide podcast.
Absolute pleasure, Tim. Thank you.
We'll be back in August. And before I leave, I want to say thank you to CI for the great support of the podcast, and also TuneTribe Entertainment Group for powering what we do.